Fancy intro here. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Thoughts from Montreal, Australia's number one car-based podcast from the state of West By God, Virginia. The By God is very important. A lot of people forget it. That's actually recorded in Montreal, in the neighborhood of Mile By God End. The By God is even more important, and even more people forget it. I'm your host, Arjuna Gonzalez. On the last episode of Thoughts from Montreal.
Everybody in the Probably Work Network who's in the US or UK right now, if you want, you and yours can come visit me in Montreal and we can talk immigration. It's tough to get in here and it's not perfect, but it's a way out of the States and turf slash plague island. And there's no expiration date on this offer. I can't promise anything, but I can tell you what I know, and my connections are your connections. Good night, good luck, and we can bring you here, probably.
And now back to the show. Oh, you guys have been here the whole time. Damn, Pete, I guess that settles it. What do we do with centrist GPT over here?
Oh, that's simple. Hey, Joe, didn't you say you were going to forgive all student loan debt for graduates of public universities and HBCUs who make under $125K a year?
No. It was always up to $20,000 a borrower.
Nice try, but I've got the article right here, Joe. You talked about it like three different times during the campaign. It was on your website.
Error. Illegal memory access. JoeBiden.exe has performed an illegal operation and must be shut down. Memory address 0xDEADEEFCAFD.
God save the Queen.
How did you have any idea that would work?
Oh, it's simple. The easiest way to make centrist Democrats walk out of a conversation is to call them out on their bullshit when they betray the working class. I'm surprised I haven't done this more often. Anyway, do we have any more content?
I don't think we do. So we should probably cut forward to a tape fast-forwarding sound effect to make it seem like we're picking things up several days later.
Sounds like a plan. Oh, right, yeah.
The notes here say just a bit of banter. What am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah, it was probably a placeholder until we could figure out how to explain what X-Defiant Fish Fry means. But it doesn't matter now, because he's here. Hey, Pete, we got content!
Cornel West is running for president with the People's Party.
What? Well, I might have to move out of Montreal. Can I have the mic?
Yeah, here you go.
Cool. Hey, listeners, Well, first off, if you don't recognize the name Cornel West, you certainly recognize the voice if you listened to the last episode.
Everything's at stake when you talk about the blues.
And to introduce this, I think I need to give you a little creator commentary about the last episode. After I decided to move to Canada, and as word got out around the people I knew IRL that I was moving, Nobody ever really tried to talk me out of leaving. I got a lot of comments to the effect of, yeah, I understand, or I wish I could move to Canada, but nobody really tried to talk me out of it. With one important exception, then State Representative Seth Berry, who was at the head of the campaign to create Pine Tree Power, which is a consumer-owned utility, which, if you remember when I ran for state representative, it was the one issue I refused to shut up about, with good reason. He messaged me on Facebook, trying to get me to go around Franklin County to collect signatures to put it on the ballot, because it failed in the legislature. And I told him, no, Seth, I'm moving to Quebec. I don't spend any time in politics these days. And he tried making the arguments that AI Joe Biden makes at the end of that episode. And I responded with the counter-arguments that Arjuna makes, and he didn't really try to offer any rebuttal beyond that. But that whole exchange really reinforced kind of a, I don't know if I want to say moral quandary, but certainly something I had been struggling with ever since I decided to emigrate, which is, you know, I'd spent 8 incredibly hectic months that would have been hectic in any other year but had the beginning of the pandemic and the murder of George Floyd on top of it. Giving all of these speeches, trying to encourage all kinds of local activism, claiming I'd try to stay involved, and I'm just up and leaving for Quebec. Because I think the U.S. is hurtling towards fascism, but for all my rhetoric, I won't stay and fight. And I felt like I very badly needed to justify the decision to leave. And using those clips from various speeches from Cornel West and structuring the last episode in such a way that I come to that monologue at the end helped a lot. It helped crystallize a lot of the things that have been going on in my head for the past 2 years. And it also just goes to show that, you know, I remember seeing Cornel West on C-SPAN when I was a teenager. And yes, I was the kind of kid that would watch C-SPAN as a teenager, to probably none of your surprise. You know, there's about 6 or 7 people, some of whom I've met, some of whom I haven't, who I can say, like, I am the person I am politically because of them. And it really drives home that he is one of them. So I did not at any point have Cornel West runs for president on my 2024 election bingo card. And I did say at the end of the episode that if I thought there were anything I could do about the giant fascist countdown timer, I would be up and out of here tomorrow. But wait a minute, he's running for the People's Party? Aren't they a clusterfuck? Yeah, let's dig up that clip from The Hill.
Renee Johnson is a volunteer and an activist, a former activist with the Movement for a People's Party. She has become an outspoken critic of the People's Party since then.
So it started when we didn't really have any indication of what we were supposed to be doing. So we didn't have real directives as to what we were supposed to be meeting about, what we were supposed to be planning, what we were supposed to be doing. We were kind of just, you know, going with the flow and trying to make things up as we went along. And then we sent a list of questions to our regional director to ask, okay, these are the things that we have some concerns about. We're not sure how to communicate with other people. We're not sure how to reach out to other volunteers. And one of the major questions was, what is going to happen with regard to New York City ballot access? Because New York is one of those 11 states where you have to run someone, and you actually have to run someone for governor. In order to get the ballot access here, you have to have over 130,000 votes, which was a change by Cuomo. And at the time last fall, Cuomo was still relatively popular, and we wanted to know what the, you know, what the national organization's plan was with regard to New York. This email we sent out late fall, the answer was, you know, we might have more information in about 6 months. We all thought that was a concern, because waiting until spring of 2021 to start planning what you were going to do in New York with regard to running for governor did not seem like a good timeline. So we had actually, as a group, decided we were just going to move forward with actions that were going to be relevant to inside of the city, inside of the state, and try not to do too much with, you know, worrying about the ballot access at that time. So that was the first key that something was really not right.
What would you do if you could, you know, what would you do to improve the situation if you could?
So that was, I was part of a group that signed a petition, and that was literally the point of the petition, right? Was write your bylaws, make things very transparent, you know, be very clear about what people are making decisions, how they're coming to those decisions, have meeting minutes, have recordings, have information, have a group together so that people who have issues within the organization have a means to communicate, to, you know, have those issues rectified. Your meetings between your quote unquote, you know, leadership should be information that people who are just volunteering for the organization are able to access. People should not have to do an IRS search for your financial transparency to find what's going on with the money.
And just an aside about finances, for the few months that I was a member of the main Democratic Party's state committee, at every meeting, they would show us this spreadsheet of where their finances were, just as like a screen share on a Zoom call, and then just stop the screen share and not share it with us. Like, they would just yank it away after like the 20 minutes that they discussed it. And screen capping it so that you could look at it later was like this super shady thing. So I'm not saying that the stuff that Renee Johnson is describing here isn't terrible, just that it's like keeping that kind of information to a small circle of people in the in-group is way more common than you might think. But yeah, that's fucked up. And I guess we have a theme for our episode, listeners. Like, how much of an L am I taking, having given Cornel West this prominent feature in the previous episode? I mean, it sure sounds like a big L. You know what? Why don't we answer one of your questions? Evan asks, have you figured out why Canada Dry is wet? It's simple. It's to confuse the Americans. Enough of the Canadian national identity is French that they have the same habit of doing weird and confusing stuff just to confuse the Americans. They don't limit it to putting accent marks in places that make no sense and don't change the pronunciation. They have to start messing with the sodas as well. Or even worse, adopting British spelling for words like center and color. Ugh. All right, well, this news about Cornel West is pretty awful, but I don't know, maybe something will come up in the news. Let's hit the fast-forward sound effect.
Oh, shit. Hey, Pete?
Arjuna, I'm sitting right behind you. We don't need to do this shtick again.
Oh, yeah, cool. There's a new Democracy Now! Clip with Cornel West. Check it out.
You know Democracy Now!, we ask very critical questions. I also want to read from a New Republic article about your candidacy and about the People's Party. While the party began in 2017 with noble roots to form a new political party independent from corporate money and influence, it's been mired in troubling allegations as well as broader organizational dysfunction. Numerous sources have corroborated sexual harassment allegations against party founder Nick Brana. Last year, former party member Paula Jean Swearingen said she'd witnessed Brana try to force himself onto former party executive director Zana Day, who confirmed the allegations herself. Numerous party board members were apparently forced out for encouraging investigations into the allegations and questioning whether Brana was still fit to lead the party, unquote. So he's the founder of the party that you're running with. Talk about why you chose the People's Party and if you would like to respond to those allegations. And also the bigger point of why you didn't choose, for example, if you wanted to be outside the race, the Green Party, which has more ballot access.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I appreciate that question, too, my dear sister. I mean, I have a great love for my Green Party brothers and sisters. I've worked twice with them, and so I have nothing against their third party operations. It would be nice if we had even a coming together, but that's something that is for a different show. But in terms of the history of the People's Party, you know, I was there at the founding. There's no doubt about that. And I've been a kind of honorary member of the board, even though I haven't participated. So I haven't followed all of the insides and outsides of what has happened. It strikes me that there's been some very bad and ugly moments. There's no doubt about that. But I don't want to adjudicate as to who actually is guilty or who's actually innocent, because I just don't know. But there has to be accountability, and especially when it comes to sexual harassment in terms of sisters of any color, those are very, very important issues to wrestle with and very serious charges in that regard. But as I said before, that for me, I wanted to be able to bring a serious critique to bear on the corporate duopoly. And the People's Party, in its inception and in its vision, is a populist one. So you got a number of different voices, heterogeneous. It is very loose. A lot of people say, well, is it an organization at all? I mean, it does anything hold it together and so forth and so on? Well, that we shall see. Those are very important questions. I don't want to act as if that they aren't serious challenges.
Okay, I have a lot of things to say about that. First off, you can't tell from the audio, but it sure looks like throughout most of the clip when he's giving that response, especially at the beginning, it seems like he is shaking. In all the times I've seen this guy on TV, I've never seen him that nervous. It really gives you the impression that he didn't know anything about all this stuff going on with the People's Party, which is extra disturbing because that clip from The Hill that I played for you was from like June, July 2021. And remember, the party was founded in 2017, and this Democracy Now! Clip is from today. What is it? June 7th, 2023. How the hell does he not know about any of this? I mean, the sexual harassment stuff is just an order of magnitude worse, but the People's Party has very clearly and very publicly had some serious organizational problems, and he just decides to run with them? Just because he was on the board? I tell you, the size of the L just keeps getting bigger.
Want to answer another question?
Yeah, I guess. Why not?
Our next question, also from Evan, is, can you do an emotional audio bit again, but this time it's a Wayne from Letterkenny fan cam with Hero by Nickelback playing in the background for comedic effect? No, I can't, Evan. But how about you, me, and Tyler do a cover of this parody of Alt-J that I put in the description? I feel like we haven't done anything like that since the Too Young for This hit episode that we did on Wayne's World, where we covered part of Bohemian Rhapsody. I want to try something like that again. And if we could get Robo Gonzalez involved, like doing the more high-pitched part, it would be perfect. Okay, back to depressing political stuff again. On second thought, no. Let's answer another question. This last one is, again, from Evan. Quick, Mom said you can stay the night. What are you bringing? I am bringing ketchup Cheetos, which is my impromptu entry into Evan's Chip Quest series that might be live by now, and that you certainly can't hear about on Twitter because Elon Musk hates podcasts about chips, or he's a complete weenie when it comes to people making fun of his idiotic Neuralink idea. Guy's an absolute dictionary definition of a man-child, I swear. For those not on our Discord, Evan, I think, created a Twitter account for this new podcast that he launched called Chip Quest, where he reviews different kinds of chips. And I guess he used the phrase chiphead somewhere as like a hashtag or something. And Twitter didn't like that because people use the term chiphead to make fun of Elon Musk fans who want to sign up for Neuralink to get a little computer chip implanted in their brain, because some people spent a lot more time watching science fiction than reading up on actual science. But anyway, ketchup Cheetos. Yes. It's nothing particularly special. It's like puffy Cheetos, but with the flavor of Canadian ketchup chips. And the Cheetos are shaped like little maple leaves. And I inhaled like half of the bag once I brought it home from the store. So would definitely recommend. It's good for leveling up your Canadian-ness stat if you're trying to get the super secret ending at the end of the Tim Hortons quest. Yeah, but I think they're a limited thing because I went to the store like not long after I got my first bag and they were completely out. So either it was that popular or I just had really good timing once. But yeah, Evan, if you ever come up to Montreal, we are getting ketchup Cheetos for sure. And now I have another headline to go over with Pete. Cornel West has left the People's Party, and he's running on the Green Party now. Let's switch to this clip from Black Power Media explaining why.
Yeah, no, again, appreciate the question. One is that, you see, when I was with Brother Bernie, which is progressive wing of the rotten corporate-dominated Democratic Party, trying to raise issues of Wall Street, Medicare for all, very weak on militarism, not strong on anti-imperialism, that you had a group of folk who broke away in 2016 because they thought Bernie should have attempted an independent run. Now, I was with those folk. So when they founded the People's Party, I was there with Sister Nina Turner and a host of others. So that was my initial connection with them. We had come out of Bernie's campaign in 2016. Then I was on the board with Sister Nina and a host of others, but didn't stay in contact at all. None whatsoever. Then I get a call from my dear brother Chris Hedges, who I have great respect for, and he says that the People's Party would like you to run for president on the third party. And I said, well, shoot, I need to think and pray on this thing. So we had a meeting and so forth. And I said, well, you know, this might be a good idea, but I should have done a closer examination of both the perceptions of the People's Party, the internal conflict that I had very, very little knowledge of. And so once I decided, in fact, they were going to run both of us. They were going to meet me and Brother Chris. And Chris's wife said no. my wife said no, but we had more prayer and so forth and said, okay, we're going to still proceed. And lo and behold, all of this stuff comes out about the what has been happening in the charges. I know they're alleged charges, but the charges and what have you. And I said, well, I will always give them credit for coming forward for asking me, but I ain't got time for this. I got to focus on the people that's suffering, their resilience and their resistance. In interviews, they would start off asking about the People's Party, and I'm trying to talk about abolition of poverty and abolition of mass incarceration and militarism and the Palestinian struggle. So I'm trying to get to my issues, and they keep talking about this. So I called the People's Party up, and Brother Nick, and say, this got to go. And then when I got the call from Brother Baraka and Sister Jill, and we had two or three long, long meetings, and I have great respect for Brother Ajamu and Sister Jill. I supported them, as you all know, when they ran, you see. And they said that you could shift to the nomination. Now, I'm not the Green Party candidate, you all know. I'm just part of the nomination process and so forth. And I said, that's cool. All I want to do is keep the focus where it belongs.
And just for context, folks, Sister Jill is Jill Stein, who was the Green Party nominee back in 2016. And Brother Baraka is Ajamu Baraka, who was her running mate.
And I said it once, and I'll say it again, I might have to move back to the States. No, I won't move back to the States, but for real, Cornel West is the only person who's made me seriously think about moving back for like 5-10 minutes. Yeah. If we keep just recording this podcast in an episodic format anytime there's a new headline about Cornel West, I'm never going to publish it because I'll just keep recording. So let's cut to a montage while I read up on all of the stuff that's happened with him, and then I can try to give you a comprehensive overview of everything I have to say about his campaign, and we can just wrap this up.
Do-do-do-do, this is montage music, do-do-do-do-do, I'll be reading up on Cornel West, do-do-do-do-do.
Hey Pete, are you gonna start with the spoiler thing? Because that's the subject of like one out of every three tweets about Cornel West for the past couple of months.
Oh, definitely. Let's start with this clip from the Majority Report with Sam Cedar, who, by the way, isn't even 100% on board with Cornel West.
Without, assessing or litigating the question of whether this is a time for him to run as a third party candidate, it makes a lot more sense
totally.
To run yeah. with a party that has at least some semblance of an infrastructure, that has at least a track record and theoretically a capability of getting, he says,
getting on the ballot.
broader access to the ballot. As far as I can tell, the People's Party had no access to the ballot.
Or I think maybe some people have said they've like got some, but it's not significant like the Green Party.
And it's not inconceivable to me that in a state like New York, in a slam dunk state, to have the opportunity to, say that as a sheer policy matter, safely without threatening the outcome of the election, yeah. to have the opportunity to,
be good for down ballot.
Good for down ballot. It'll be good also, just the opportunity as to say like, okay, I get to allow myself, a freebie. Mm. That's not a bad thing in my estimation. I've been clear many times before. In 2000, I voted for Nader in New York State. I thought it was a freebie. I think I may have even gone on to somebody had set up a vote swap. For Florida, Nader had said going into the election that he would not contest in states that were close because they wanted to build the Green Party ostensibly and didn't want to threaten the election. The rest is history in Florida. He ran there. Other places, there's a lot of other reasons why Florida ended up going to Bush.
TLDR, most of you listening to this podcast are not in competitive states. When I vote from abroad, my vote is going to get counted in Maine, in the 2nd Congressional District. Now, statewide, Maine is going for Biden easily. Maine and New- Maine and Nebraska are the two states that split their electoral votes by congressional district, if I remember right. I don't think that's changed. And at the same time, I know that the second congressional district is going for Trump. It's a sure thing because the Democratic Party in Maine doesn't have object permanence northwest of I-95. That's a Maine geography joke. It basically means they don't know rural areas exist. Evan and Jess, you know better than I do that West Virginia is going for Trump. Troy, you know better than I do that Oregon is going for Biden. Tyler and Eric, I hate to say it, but it at least sure looks to me like Florida is going for Trump pretty safely, and I've got an article on the pretty dire state of the Florida Democratic Party to help back up that claim. Cornel West is going to be on the ballot in all four of those states, and so you can vote for him and help get the Green Party to the 5% it needs for those FEC matching funds. And if there's a vote swap program, you can even, and I don't know that they're putting together a vote swap type thing that Sam talked about, but maybe you can do that so that somebody in a competitive state can vote for Biden if you vote for Cornell. And you know what? I'm not going to sit here and judge you if you live in a competitive state and vote for him. For one thing, I know at least one former Democratic politician who has indirectly weighed in on this issue. On the other hand, how does integrity face oppression? What does courage do in the face of brute force? Well, the answer isn't in trying the same tired bullshit that has been shown over and over again not to work. But I think Cornel West says it better than I can in this clip from The Breakfast Club.
I see that the Democrats and a lot of progressives are saying they wish you wouldn't run, saying that your presidential bid could cripple President Biden's potential run. How does that feel to be that kind of threat, to be that kind of disruptor?
Well, it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. No, man, that's what it means to be a servant of the people. You see that Harriet Tubman was a threat to the white supremacist order. Frederick Douglass was a threat. That's why he put a bounty on his head. Ida B. Wells was a threat against lynching and American terrorism, Jim and Jane Crow. That's why they put a bounty on his head. Martin King, Fannie Lou Hamer, they were threats. And what does it mean to be a threat? What it means to be a threat is you calling into question an order that's predicated on too much suffering of precious everyday people. Mm. Now, the funny thing for me is, you know, here it is. I haven't had one public event. I haven't had one fundraiser. Mm-hmm. And they say I'm a threat and a menace to the constitutional order. Mm. I say, yeah, that's what I need to be doing. That's precisely what I need to be doing, you see. Because the Constitution was pro-slavery in practice for 75 years. Mm-hmm. It's pro-Jim and Jane Crow in practice for 100 years. These days, the new Jim Crow. I always begin, as a Christian, I begin with the least of these. Mm-hmm. You see? Mm-hmm. Which means I look at the world through the lens of my partners who incarcerated. I've been mm-hmm. blessed to teach in prisons for 41 years. Mm-hmm. Now, I ask the Democrats, what are you doing about mass incarceration? Biden, you was the architect of it, with a white supremacist named Thurman.
That's right.
With Strom. What are you doing about mass incarceration? I want to know. If you're not doing about it, how am I spoiling your votes? Mm-hmm. You're not speaking to the needs of my people. You're not speaking to the needs of those who are suffering.
That's right.
So I'm not a spoiler. I'm casting a spotlight on that which you don't want to come to terms with. If you were really concerned about the issues I'm concerned about, then steal my thunder. Mm. Be on the cutting edge of eliminating mass incarceration. Mm. Be on the cutting edge of abolishing of poverty, abolishing homelessness. And if you really want to speak to the issues, be on the edge of trying to gain access to workers with a living wage. Then I wouldn't have no ground.
That's right.
You see? So they think that but people say, well, it's just a personal thing. It's just a vanity thing. Please, I just turned 70 years old. The last thing I want to do is be wrestling with the issues in the American empire that have to do with just how sick and indifferent and callous our elites are when it comes to poor people and working people.
But even if you put all of that aside, maybe you think any kind of third-party presidential run is just a waste of time and effort because we have a first-past-the-post voting system, and we need something like ranked choice voting for third parties to have any amount of power and influence. And if you don't know what ranked choice voting is, It's another voting system where instead of just voting for one candidate, you rank the different candidates on the ballot, and if after the first count no candidate has a majority, then the candidate with the fewest votes gets disqualified, and for the voters who listed that candidate as their first choice, those votes get reallocated to their second choices. If that doesn't make any sense, check out the link that I left in the description about ranked choice voting. It was put together by the Maine Secretary of State's office a few years ago. It walks you through the actual process of eliminating candidates and reallocating their votes. And it's absolutely not the way I've heard some people describe it, where you're quote-unquote just voting for everyone. I've done it enough times to know that you're very clearly communicating a preference, and what's better is those extra preferences that you list there don't get just completely erased because you only selected one candidate. Now, this was a major point of contention in a recent Bad Faith / Crystal Kyle and Friends crossover episode that I had fun listening to.
Third parties haven't gotten a single electoral vote in 50
years. And it's like round and round.
No, but it's true because, I mean, look at Ross Perot had all the money in the world. It didn't matter.
He didn't get one electoral vote.
He didn't get one electoral vote.
Do you agree that ranked choice voting needs to come first? That's the important question. Do you agree that if we get ranked choice voting, then yes, overnight third parties become more viable.
I think that Cornel
West. But until we get them, they're not viable.
I think that Cornel West running in a general election where he has been doing this. He's been talking about ranked choice voting in interviews, but continuing to talk about how the onus is on the Democratic Party to prevent the spoiler effect. He is in a position now running in a general election every time he goes on TV to say, if you're upset at me at being a spoiler, you need to look at the Democratic Party who across the country for the last decades has been purposefully undermining any ballot measures that effectively put into effect ranked choice voting in Maine, in North Carolina, the way they attacked Matthew Ho. I am not the enemy, they are. And that's the burden shifting, the narrative burden shifting I think the left should be engaged in right now.
Now, what Kyle Kalinske is also glossing over is that without candidates creating a viable spoiler threat, you can try to change the Democratic Party all you want to get ranked choice voting. They're not going to have any reason to do it. People don't put in the time and legwork to change something as fundamental as how they vote for candidates for office, just on some abstract idea that it would be a better way to do things. The only reason we have ranked choice voting in Maine is because we had back-to-back gubernatorial elections where there was a third-party candidate who did well enough to be a spoiler and throw the election to an alpha build of Trump. You know, Cornel West keeps mentioning Frederick Douglass. There's that famous quote of his, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will." I've seen a lot of weak-sauce activism in my adult life, focused on changing conversations and putting ideas out there and raising awareness and scoring moral victories. But you know what? To actually get anywhere, you have to be willing to play chicken like this. Because as a former candidate, I know from firsthand experience that the Democratic leadership is made up of just as many power-hungry sociopaths as the GOP. They're just better at appearing more polite about it. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. Now, I don't want to sound like I'm 1,000% all in for Cornel West. I'm only 500% in for him. In all the different headlines that have come out around his campaign, there are one or two things that I find not so much bad as ambiguous. And I keep coming back to this question. How much of an L am I taking, having put all of those clips of his in the previous episode and now having put even more clips of him in this episode? I can at least make it so that you can't say I didn't mention the stuff that I'm about to talk about. So let's start with the tax stuff. There was an article in the Daily Beast claiming that he owes about $500,000 in back taxes, and not just back taxes, but also child support. And it's interesting how it's structured. You can find the link in the description and read it for yourself. But it goes through all of the stuff about his back taxes and then adds the child support thing as just kind of a last thing dropped at the end without a whole lot of context, not a whole lot of background, not a whole lot of added explanation. That doesn't mean that there isn't something there, but remembering what I read, that stands out to me now. I did respond to it in this clip on Tim Black's show.
Well, one is, I mean, child support is a lie. I've always put high priority on my kids. In fact, I've treated them in an even lavish way, because I've always believed that they had a priority beyond anything else. And so when it comes to that particular front, that's just not true. It's just a matter of it's not recorded, but it's not true. But when it comes to the taxes, that's definitely true. I've been broke as the Ten Commandments since 1984. I've had waves of audits, waves of levies, waves of liens, and then the liabilities and the fees build up. So you get in the black hole. And I've always been honest about that. Always been honest about that. I am exactly like 63% of hardworking citizens in America who live paycheck to paycheck with dignity and determination. I say, hey, I got to do it. Now, my paycheck's bigger than everyday working people. Ain't no doubt about that. My paycheck is bigger, but then my debts are big. So I've never denied that I was broke in that way. But I have my agreements with the IRS. I think people ought to pay their fair taxes, especially the 1%. Most of the 1% don't pay their fair tax. But people ought to pay their fair taxes, including myself. But it's clear to me that you got folk who will find anything or manufacture anything in order to attack your character when you're trying to tell the truth and bear witness, especially on the chocolate side of town. They're going to find anything, no doubt. So that, fine, let folk, you know, pursue the truth in a fair way, but at the same time, let them know that I'm honest enough to acknowledge the degree to which, yes, I've been behind on taxes. And the liabilities and the fees build up, and you make an agreement and you continually pay and make sure you pay. And I think large numbers of people understand what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's always been the case.
Now, on the one hand, saying the child support thing is a lie could totally be true. I just feel like there's some context missing to all of this on both sides of it. I, for one, will give him a pass on this. I can totally understand if you listening to this podcast would draw a different conclusion or would honestly need more information. I mean, as I was putting this part of the podcast together, it was around the same time as that Channel 4 investigation into Russell Brand with all of the really serious and credible sexual assault allegations against him. And what's his defense? Oh, it's the Matrix out to get me! At the same time, what's out there in public at the time of this recording that I know about Cornel West's situation is not anywhere near as damning or at the same level of detail. So let's move on to the other ambiguous thing, and it's about his campaign organization. Now, I've got several election cycles worth of campaign organizing experience, yes, at the state legislative level, but I know what presidential campaign infrastructure looks like, because I've seen it on the ground. And in the first month or three after he announced, I was going on Facebook, trying meetup.com, and maybe I'm still stuck in 2003 because I think of Howard Dean's campaign, and I think that meetup.com is actually a way to do political organizing when it isn't anymore. How do the kids these days organize election campaigns anyway? And I didn't see anything that looked like a campaign organization forming. Yeah, there was a Cornel West for Maine chapter, but the description said, oh, we're going to start organizing dinner parties. Do you have any idea how bougie you instantly sound to most Mainers if you use the phrase dinner party? But that aside, while I was researching this podcast, there was a new development on it when Cornel West brought on Peter Dow, of all people, as his new campaign manager. Peter Dow? For those of you who don't spend too much time on left American Twitter, was this pretty infamous, like, diehard Hillary Clinton supporter in 2016. Textbook establishment Democrat, had this site called Verit, which I don't even know how I would explain it. I guess it was just something that posted, like, Hillary Clinton quotes or something. It was incredibly stupid. Before that, had a background in comms for some campaigns, and in the blogosphere after that. In 2020, he did a complete 180, became a Bernie supporter, and now he's Cornel West's campaign manager. And Look, I've obviously never been involved at that level in a presidential campaign before, but if I extrapolate what I know from the state legislative level up to the national level, having been a campaign manager in 2006 and then a candidate in 2020, and having been in the inner circle of many a state legislative candidate in, let's see, 04, 08, to a certain extent, 10, and then 20, a good campaign manager does need to be good at PR and speaking with the press, because they're inevitably in front of the cameras a lot of the time. But they also need to have a very high level of managerial skill, because a political campaign is kind of like a pop-up business that runs for a little over a year, depending on how long the election cycle is. Think about it. You've got an organization that's doing all sorts of events, involving all sorts of volunteers in theoretically all 50 states, or probably like two dozen of them, the ones that seem relatively competitive. Nothing about what I know about Peter Dow suggests that he's good at that part of the job, which is going to be absolutely vital, if not even more important than his comms skills, in order to get Cornel West to the 5%. Because Cornel West, you just put the guy in front of a microphone and he'll get people fired up. He's better than Trump in some respects in that way. But you need an organization for people who are going to knock on doors and work to get out the vote and handle all of the data analysis and data management that comes with that kind of thing.
Hey everyone, Editor RoboG here. Peter Dow just went on the Bad Faith podcast, and have I got the clip for you?
If I can, if I may, just speak briefly to this idea of who's a good campaign manager. You know,
please do.
Yeah, because this is it's a very specific skill, right? So, Dr. West and I had our initial conversation, we talked about what that means. What is a campaign manager's role? You know, maybe I would be in an advisory role. We had, as I said to Savvy, we had one conversation, and then I didn't hear a thing. With Dr. West and his wife, Anahita. So I don't think people recognize it. It's like having been in so many campaigns, especially really big Democratic ones, where the staff in New Hampshire is like five times the size of say, you know, one of these smaller, even presidential campaigns. You know, the big campaigns, we're talking about massive offices in every state and, you know, 50, 100 staffers, thousands of volunteers. These are massive operations. We're talking billions of dollars on campaigns. So having been in the war rooms, which is really the heart of the campaign of both the Kerry and the Clinton campaign, where you're really working with the leadership of the campaign. You know, at the Kerry campaign, it was Susan Rice on one side of me, and I'm trying to remember, you know, some of the other people. You know, the most senior people in the campaign are in the war room, and that's where the candidate will spend their time. So I lived in two war rooms for 2 years of my life, plus all the congressional work and working on Marianne. And all that experience is basically to say, you have to know everybody's job better than everyone on your team. So when I'm having a conversation about NGP Dan or Nation Builder or Action Network or some sort of you know, CRM platform or email platform, I literally have to know all the technology myself so that I can talk to the team. When it comes to volunteer mobilization, when it comes to all the various aspects, fundraising, finance, messaging, communication, social media, is this TikTok video edited properly? And so it's a skill set of knowing every single aspect of the campaign as well, if not better, than the team you're leading. And that comes from many years of experience.
Damn, RoboG. I record corrected because he described the kind of campaign machinery that I know, but scaled up 100,000 times, which is exactly what I was imagining. So with all those disclaimers out of the way, I still support Cornel West, enough to give him a donation. Hey everyone, Pete here. I'm about to click the donate button on cornelwest24.org and make another donation. There is a checkbox on this form that says send email updates, so hopefully they aren't going to just completely flood my inbox like the DNC does, but maybe I'll get some information out of this about what kind of organization he and Peter Dow et al. Are putting together that will help clarify some of what we've covered in this episode. I guess stay tuned for Thoughts from Montreal 3. I don't even know if I'm going to talk about this or if it's all going to be Quebec Solidaire stuff. Oops, spoilers! Well, that's weird. I just clicked donate now and it said there was an error and it just says invalid account. Is their donate form broken or did I mess something up? It said my card was declined. Maybe I need to go back to my credit union and tell them I'm living in Canada now, but I gave them my new address not too long ago. Well, there's no way I can make a donation with my Canadian credit card. I need to check my email, see what's going on. Because I know there's enough money on my debit card to make this donation. I transferred a whole bunch down from my Canadian bank account for my student loan payment and some money on top of this, so this should work. Okay, I'm not getting any clear answers about this. Maybe if I do try donating from my Canadian credit card, I mean, it's from my own funds, and they'll do the currency exchange, so it should work. And there's nothing in the rules and regulations that says I can't make a donation from a foreign bank account if I'm a U.S. citizen. All right. I'm glad the exchange rate with the Canadian to U.S. dollar is better now than when I got up here. Click. You cross your fingers, right? Hey, thank you for contributing. Did it really go through? Yes, it did. I'm gonna go ahead and tweet this. Wow, recording thoughts from Montreal 2. Is this content? Sir Rajata? Post. Cool. Yeah, I guess I'm including this in the podcast because this is just a little glimpse of the kind of crap that I've had to go through moving my whole life to another country. Okay, back to the show.
Hey Pete, it's editor Robo Gonzalez again. Peter Dow put out a tweet with a general call for volunteers right here. It reads, serious about ending the duopoly? Do you want to build a movement while others just talk about it? Great, we need you. Email a brief summary of your organizing experience or other campaign skills to mobilize@cornellwest2024.com. I promise your email will be read even if you don't get an immediate response. And sign up to volunteer at cornellwest2024.com. You know, you could send them your CV and you've got campaign management experience, you've run as a candidate before, you know the Democratic Party machinery, and even if it's horrible, you still learned a lot of how to do this stuff. Maybe you should reach out.
What the hell are you doing, Robo-G? Pete's on the way to permanent residency in Quebec. He's got his job at Ubisoft, and we haven't gotten to that yet, but he's getting slowly but surely dragged into Quebec Solidaire. You know this stuff is like heroin to him. He'd have to go back to America if he did that.
Well, I don't know if I have a politics heroin addiction, but you're both right.
And then he procrastinated for 24 hours before starting to record again.
Okay, I'm back. As much as I want to say, there's very little, if any, chance that Cornell West is going to win. Doing something as drastic as quitting my job and moving back to the States just to work on a campaign that I might not even get paid for, or if I do get paid, it's not going to compare to the salary that I make here at Ubisoft, is just an incredibly stupid thing to do. I can't, for some reason, say that and move on. So what I am going to do is just sit on this until I get this episode out the door, and then the people who I know and trust the most will understand what I've been struggling with as all of these different headlines come out and everything develops, so I can at least have an informed discussion with said people. Fact is, the politician you guys got to know in 2020 just woke up from a 3-year nap. He's not going back to sleep anytime soon. The only thing we can do is try to manage him in such a way that I can still pay the bills. But believe me, when I said at the end of the last episode, if I knew I could do anything worth a damn in the States about the fascist takeover we all know is coming, I'd pick up and be out of here tomorrow. I 1000% meant it. Okay, I guess that's all the American politics stuff I wanted to talk about. So now we can wrap up the podcast, right, Arjuna?
Nope, because there's now a three-person race for the co-spokeswoman at the head of Quebec Solidaire. And the three candidates are Christine Labrie, the MNA from Sherbrooke. You remember Fox from Sherbytown? That's Sherbrooke. Ruba Ghazal, who represents the area that we're recording this podcast in. And Émilie Lessard-Therrien, who we're going to call ELT from now on because I love you guys, but some of y'all cannot speak any more French beyond ho-ho, baguette, croissant, omelette de fromage, voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir?
Tabarnak. Well, who hasn't wanted to sleep with a cheese omelette at least once? Okay, you're going to do the thing, right?
What's the thing?
Hey, everybody.
Hey, everybody what?
Canadian history and
Hey, everybody. Canadian history and politics, Arjuna here. So remember, the Canadian Parliament and all of the, in American terms, state legislatures, here it's called the National Assembly, work on something like the Westminster model in the UK, where there are party leaders for each political party, and if that party gets a majority or a plurality of seats, then the leader of that party becomes the premier if it's a province, or a prime minister if it's the federal parliament. Now, Quebec Solidaire, because they're big on gender equality, and as any good leftist party should be, has two co-spokespeople, so two co-leaders at the head of the party. One man, one woman. The co-spokeswoman, until recently, was Manon Massé, who is stepping down, and so now that seat is open and they're having an election for it. Now, I just dropped a bunch of names on you, but there's like a whole cast of characters that you should know a few things about before we get into what Pete thinks of this whole situation. So let's cut to this clip from Nora Loretto, who's a popular leftist journalist and podcaster and Twitter person, who's one of the few English speakers who actually has like good insight into Quebec provincial politics. And here she is talking about the results of last year's election. Hey everyone, it's Arjuna again. Real quick, I need to give some vocabulary words for the Americans listening. Riding means district. It can be the district that elects the provincial member of the National Assembly, or MNA, or it can refer to the district that elects the member of parliament in the federal parliament in Ottawa. Racialized means person of color, and fonderie is a smelting works, like a foundry.
90 seats for the CAC. That's our like center-right paternalist sort of racist. Yeah, racist party. The Liberals, 21 seats. The QS, their center-right party, QS, Quebec Solidaire, the left-ish party, 11 seats. The Parti Québécois down to 3. And hilariously, it's very funny, the Conservative Party, the far-right freak party of Éric Duhaime, got 0 seats.
Yeah, I was very, very pleased to see Haroun Bouazi win. Haroun was running in Maurice Richard in Montreal riding, and he's a friend of mine, and he's, I think, exactly what the CAQ is probably the most scared of when it comes to someone who can point out their hypocrisy, who understands capitalism better than they do, who can talk to a wider audience of people. And Haroun, I think, really represents, if Quebec Solidaire is serious about trying to be the party of all Quebecers, Haroun is definitely someone who represents that. And it's been a long time since we've had someone who's like an intellectual socialist, as the mouthpiece of the party. You know, and I'm obviously thinking of Amir Kadir. Mm-hmm. And so I think I really hope that he'll be able to continue like to be himself. Of course, the party machine might not allow that, but that gives me a lot of hope. Seeing Verdun go Quebec Solidaire also, you know, first time since 1939 that they didn't elect a Liberal candidate. And Alejandra Zaga Mendez is a longtime student activist and activist. She's the president of the party, recently elected. I think she was only elected maybe 2 years ago, max. Mm. The loss also, I think, is important to talk about. You know, Émilie Therrien-Lessard, mm-hmm. from Rouen, she took on the Fonderie Orne, like the biggest polluter in the community that is causing really high rates of cancer, and she lost. And that is a big reminder that when you take on industry, especially in a place where that industry has outsized power, like in Rouen or like in the riding of Abitibi West, I think like that's a cautionary tale. I don't think it's a comment on progressive politics. I think it's a comment on how industry has always got its hands in in politics. And so at the same time as Emily's losing her seat, Sol Zanetti winning his seat in a similar riding, a riding that also has very, very, very high levels of pollution, specifically nickel dust that's in the air. He won. Now, the concentration of industry is much different in Jean Lesage, which is the riding. So in Limoilou-Beauport, there you have the Port de Québec. So like that's a lot of industries that are operating. The port itself obviously is one kind of one industry, but then you also have, you know, all the container ships, and you have all of the Papier White Birch, the paper factories down there that touches St. Roch as well, which is just right beside it in the riding that I live in Taschereau. But the fact that Sol, I mean, he barely won in 2018. He didn't have a landslide in 2022, but industry couldn't stop him, is also for me very, very exciting. So there you have the two kind of questions, the environment and a question of identity. And and while I think you know, the identity question often gets so boiled down to Montreal versus the rest of the province, mm-hmm. I think that it's actually more interesting to look at it as urban centers versus everyone else, because mm-hmm. at the end of the day, it wasn't just Montreal that went QS. It was a band of Montreal that went QS in a sea of liberals, plus, you know, the extremities, one CAC, one Piquist, and Sherbrooke and Quebec City. And I think that that is quite, that's quite interesting.
Okay. I think that sets it all up for you. Is that right, Pete?
Yeah, there's just one problem. It's almost 11 o'clock right now, so I think the next section of this podcast is going to have to be a Sleepy Time Thoughts segment. I'm already like 80% of the way through a cup of chamomile tea. So, yeah. Transition! Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sleepy Time Politics Talk. I'm your host, Pierre Bourgelet. And today we're going to talk about the co-spokeswoman race for Québec Solidaire. So, there's like two ways that I can go at this. And thanks, Arjuna, for giving some more context to all this. I can go by who's endorsed who, and I can go by the policies of the different candidates. So I did a whole bunch of digging around, and from what I can tell, if you go over like all those different MNAs and candidates that Nora Loretto talked about, Haroun Bouazizi endorsed Christine Labrie, as did Alejandra Zaga Mendez, but Sol Zanetti endorsed Ruba Gazal. So, if I just go by who has supported who, it seems like kind of a mixed bag. It's also interesting that she said that she likes Haroun Bouazizi because it's been a long time since we had an intellectual socialist at the head of the party, and she cited Amir Kadir as an example. So some history first. Amir Kadir was the first person ever elected to the National Assembly as a Québec Solidaire person. And he was elected here in this riding that I'm recording in, called Mercier. And in 2018, when he decided not to run for re-election, he endorsed Ruba Gazal. And I went back and looked at the press from that time, and she didn't have any kind of opposition, so sounded like he fully supported her. Now, if I go by policies, it's a much more clear-cut decision. And that's probably the better rubric anyway. So all three of these candidates have campaign websites. And the most fleshed-out one is Ruba Gazal's website. She has, like, a whole platform written out in French, but I could understand it, talking about the different things that she wants to advocate for if she becomes co-spokeswoman. And the one that really sealed the deal for me was this rule that she wants one person, one vote for leadership elections. Now, Americans, this election that I'm talking about is the equivalent of the not really presidential primary because Quebec isn't independent yet, but a governor's race primary, right? But they run it kind of like how the Democratic Party elects its presidential candidates. They have delegates that they elect, and then they send them to a convention which elects the candidate. And I have seen so much fuckery go down with the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections. I'm like, fuck that. Yes, please, one person, one vote. Now, if I go to Christine Labrie's site or ELT's site, I'm probably talking too loud for this time of night. Let's come over here to the pillow listeners while I talk to you about...
Hey, sleepy time, Pete.
Hey, sleepy time, Pete. This is Editor Robo-G. That was a very bad idea. Getting your mouth that close to the mic on your phone makes this audio way too loud. So I'm just going to come in here and summarize what you said next. Now, looking at the websites for the other two candidates, Christine Labrie and Émilie Lesartérien, or ELT, their websites are what we in the election campaign business call a palm card. It's a card that's supposed to be the size that you can fit it in your palm, and it has some very, very basic information about the candidate. Most of it is taken up by their photo. Maybe there's space for some policy positions, but sometimes not even that. Now, but what is on the site is just a lot of slick politician language that reads kind of like the old George W. Bushism. I know what it's like to put food on your family, and I don't want to vote for a candidate like that. Okay, to be completely fair, there's like these statements about Wendigo spokeswoman who can speak to issues outside of the island of Montreal or to the issues in rural areas. They don't elaborate on it that much, and they don't say anything about how they want to change how the party operates internally. And Ruba Ghazal definitely does, which goes back to his point about one person, one vote for leadership elections. Pete, me, Arjuna, we have all seen how the delegate system works out in the Democratic Party, and it is anything but democratic. So in the end, the candidate we like the most is Ruba Ghazal. But there's another nuance to this. To really make sense of these headlines, you need a level of inside information that you can only get from getting involved in the party. So the only way to do it is to get involved in something like the party convention at the end of November, where they're going to elect their co-spokeswoman, which means he should support the candidate where he has the most chance of becoming a delegate for said candidate, which, because we live in Mercier, which is Ruba Ghazal's riding, she's the obvious choice of the person to support.
Hey everyone, Editor Peter here. And what Editor Robo-G forgot, he forgot two things. First, all three of these candidates are basically good and the same on... First, all three candidates are pretty much the same and very good on most of the issues that progressive voters on either side of the U.S.-Canada border would be concerned about. Economic inequality, climate change, feminism. Second, that said, just like with Cornel West, there is a little bit of a good and ambiguous situation when it comes to Ruba Ghazal. The good I've already covered. The ambiguous is she has some language towards the end of her platform about how the party needs to appeal more to the suburbs. Now, as some of you Americans know, that is usually code for move to the right.
Hey everyone, editor Arjuna here. The most infamous recent example of this is when Chuck Schumer fought Hillary Clinton was going to win the 2016 election by being this centrist neoliberal candidate who de-emphasized economic issues because, and the link to this quote is in the description, for every blue-collar worker in Western Pennsylvania we lose, we'll pick up two moderate Republicans in the suburbs. And you can repeat that in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Only you couldn't. It was all bullshit.
And I think that tends to track as well in Canada. Like, the equivalent that they have of battleground states is, among other places, the Toronto suburbs, which will often switch between the Liberal or Conservative parties, which are both center-left-ish sometimes, and center-right, although increasingly fascist. And my lunch is done. All right. I gotta eat and get back to work. Bye.
We're in for quite a few lessons about how they politic in Quebec. and all of them in French. And I think this all sets up the next clip, so here it is.
All right, listeners, now that I've donated to Cornel West, it's time for me to do the other political thing that I plan to do while recording this episode, and that's fill out the form to sign up as a supporter for Ruba Ghazal's leadership campaign. And it's all in French, but I'll just live translate it here as I go along. Do you plan on being a delegate to the Congress in November, aka the party convention they're having in November where they elect the co-spokesperson? And I'll put down yes. Hey, Editor Arjuna, did we go over what we know about the delegate election process?
Nope.
Nope, because even at editing time, the Mercier Association has said very little about how they're selecting delegates. I don't think this is too confidential. I mean, it was in an email. They said they think they can send 30 delegates to the convention, but they don't say anything about how these delegates will get elected. Or selected. Or what.
Okay, well, I'm just going to skip that for now, and you can go ahead and explain it if you want. Especially because I don't know as I'm recording, and maybe you do in the future.
Oh, you sweet summer child.
And submit. And we're done. There actually is another thing I need to do, which is send in basically a nominating petition signature. So yeah, I think I will do that offline though. Bye! Phew! Okay, I don't care how many more countries we could talk about. This podcast is wrapping up. You wanna play the outro music, RoboG? Oh, no. We're not ending on blue notes. Do you got something a little less melancholic? I don't think we're ending on a note that sad. Yeah, that's better. We have solidarity in the face of catastrophe. That's from the Cornel West clip we'll use to end the episode. Before he got in the race, I didn't think the word solidarity existed in the American vocabulary. And even if he has no chance of winning, he still represents a cause worth fighting for. And that alone might draw me back to the States. And on the other side of the border, even a year after moving here and seeing all of Quebec's warts, it sure looks like the Solidaire and Quebec Solidaire ain't here for nothing. So I don't know what's gonna happen next, listeners. But as long as I'm here, the offer to talk immigration still stands. Good night, good luck, and we can bring you here, probably.
That's catastrophe. The problem of our politicians, they think ecological catastrophe is just a problem because they have managerial mentalities, something that they can get their hands around and come up with some incremental response as if we're not living on the edge of the cliff. This is catastrophe. This is the blues all the way down. But we all are the blues men and blues women because the response of catastrophe is to never allow it to have the last word. We have solidarity in the face of catastrophe. Let us march together. Let us fight together. Let us laugh together. Let us dance together. Let us smile together. Let us cry together. From our indigenous people all across the country and the world, yes, we will not allow the organized greed to have the last word.